dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The Bush-Cheney Republican era has been one of gangster wars, unrestrained corporate greed and criminality, surveillance, repression, lies, and torture, all cheered on by a media dominated by bellicose bullies. Some characterize this as aberrant, but it is aberrant only in its excess. It's the ultimate expression of a state based on hierarchies of dominance that worships competition and power. From the international to the personal, its institutions break people to its yoke from childhood. Its rulers give lip service to democracy but despise it, in fact. Full spectrum dominance is what they desire. Change was the mantra of the recent election. I don't know what vision was in each voter's mind, but I suppose some version of peace and happiness, some relief from stress and fear, some turning towards kindness, beauty, and community. The obstacle to all these things is the passion to rule the world, to be number one, to be one up by putting others down. If we want change, we shall have to fight for it on every level, from the geopolitical to the personal. We'll survey some of that terrain on the program this week. From questions of war and peace to schoolyard bullies, the template is the same. And what is actually happening is usually the opposite of what is being claimed. Take, for example, the present controversy about the so-called missile shield being placed by the U.S. establishment in countries on the borders of Russia, though it is claimed to be a defense against Iran. Obviously, the Russians don't believe that, nor should they, given the history and purpose of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. We'll begin the program with a talk on the role of the U.S. nuclear arsenal, given by Joseph Gerson last year that I've been saving for the right moment, which I think is now. He spoke in Los Angeles and was recorded by Voices for Global Justice, who will introduce the speaker.
Joseph Gerson has been involved in the justice and peace movement since the mid-1960s and was a Vietnam-era draft resister. He is the Director of Programs for the American Friends Service Committee, the principal Quaker peace organization in the United States. His previous books include The Sun Never Sets and With Hiroshima Eyes. Joseph Gerson discusses his newest book, Empire and the Bomb, published in 2007, where he details the role of the atomic bomb in U.S. foreign policy and points out how every president since the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki has threatened the use of nuclear war in its pursuit of imperial ambitions. Joseph Gerson spoke for the American Friends Service Committee at the Los Angeles chapter meeting on May 21, 2007.
Thank you. Thank you for coming this evening. I want to start with a little bit of news along the way. When Senator Hillary Clinton came to New Hampshire to launch her campaign at Concord High School, it was, as you can imagine, the structured event, everything going according to plan, except for when Senator Clinton went to leave Concord High School. where a woman named Ann Miller caught her at the doorway and said, "Senator Clinton, when you join President Bush in saying that all options should be on the table in dealing with Iran, do you really mean that we should be threatening genocide against all of that country's women and children?" And Senator Clinton looked at her and said, "I meant what I said." Then Anne asked her if she would vote against the new nuclear weapons, the so-called reliable replacement warheads, a whole new generation of hydrogen bombs that President Bush wants to build. And Senator Clinton said, "I don't want to talk about it," turned on her heel, and walked away. But Anne is a pretty gutsy young woman, and so she sat down and wrote it up and managed to get it placed as an op-ed in the conservative newspaper in New Hampshire, the dominant paper, the Manchester Union Leader. And we began sending it out over the email so people could continue to ask Senator Clinton about this. And when she got to Iowa, she was asked by people in an allied organization if she would vote against new nuclear weapons. And this time she had her answer ready, and she said, "Yeah, I'll vote against them." And others in the Democratic field have now joined her. So we can have some impact. In the tradition of news being what happens to you along the way, I was in a bookstore in Iowa City when my cell phone went off, and it was a voice that was somewhat familiar, and he was asking if this was an appropriate time to do an interview. He was calling from the English language service of Radio Tehran in Iran. And he had a number of questions, and I made it a point to kind of write down the questions he was asking me because they kind of reflect what the concerns and the views are from the people at the other end of all options being on the table. And I think it's important that we think about what that is. The ostensible reason for the interview was that there was a meeting going on in Vienna called the Nuclear Nonproliferation Review Treaty PrepCon, which is in preparation for the review of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which will take place in the year 2010. And he wanted to know what that was about. So I explained to him, you know, that the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty was one of the central bargains of the 20th century. Equally important, I think, is Yalta or the Versailles Agreement that was used to end the First World War. And in it, the non-nuclear powers swore that they would not get nuclear weapons. They, you know, made it international law. But in exchange, the nuclear powers, led by the United States, made two promises. First, that we would provide them with nuclear technology and nuclear materials for generation of nuclear power, which was a big mistake, but it's what we did. And secondly, that they would, in Article 6, they pledged to negotiate the complete elimination of their nuclear arsenals, which, of course, hasn't been done. So I had to go back to that. And that the NPT review conference is a way in which all parties to the treaty can be held accountable. He then asked me about Article 6 and said, "Well, why isn't the United States implementing it?" And so I said in Boston and Cambridge, I was invited to a conference where one of the main speakers was John Deutsch, who was head of the CIA in the first Clinton administration. I asked him, you know, "Well, when is the United States going to move to implement Article 6? And John Deutsch told me in no uncertain terms, and I have it on tape, that the United States never intended, nor does it intend now, to implement Article 6. That's just what you have to say to get what you want out of a conference. Well, the rest of the world, this was not exactly shocking news to the people in Iran, and it's part of what is motivating their nuclear program. He said, "Well, now that Washington has agreed on a new design for a new generation of nuclear weapons, you know, how should we understand this?" And I told him, "Well, they have agreed on a design for the, you know, the misnamed reliable replacement warhead, but I was able to tell him that I've got some good news. That it looks like we may be able to defeat this in Congress." Let me hit the points that I want to try to cover. The first, as we, you know, sit here, stand here on the western shore of the U.S. continental empire, I want to talk a little bit about how the United States is an empire. Talk about the fact that the U.S. nuclear arsenal has not been about nuclear deterrence. It's been about essentially enforcing that empire. To at least point to and talk about some of the more than 30 occasions when the United States has prepared or threatened to initiate nuclear war I want to underline that, initiate nuclear war in order to enforce its global power. But do we have some new and unexpected allies? Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, former Secretary of Defense Perry, have all signed an op-ed article in the Wall Street Journal saying that the U.S. nuclear arsenal has become counterproductive, that our preparations and threats of nuclear war are generating proliferation, and that it's time for us to begin implementing Article 6. That's quite a change. Now, their agenda is a little bit different than ours. I think they view that if we can get rid of nuclear weapons, the United States can dominate the world from space. So we have to kind of look at this in all of its complexities. Well, let me begin by just reminding us what nuclear weapons do. You know, since the early 80s, when we had the massive wave of the U.S. freeze movement, you know, a new generation has come of age, if not fully of consciousness, and the memory of what took place in Hiroshima and Nagasaki is long gone. So let's begin by remembering that the city of Hiroshima was completely destroyed in 9 seconds. Between Hiroshima and Nagasaki, about 200,000 people were killed rather quickly, and then came the deaths from radiation. So let me then explain why we A-bombed Hiroshima, why the United States is wed as it is to nuclear weapons, and why Iran might want nuclear weapons. First of all, since the end of the Cold War, it's become kosher for U.S. leaders to admit that the United States is an empire and long has been an empire. One of the quotes in my book is from the New York Times, quoting a quote-unquote senior Bush advisor, telling the man who's interviewing him, look, we're an empire. We create reality. You can study it. By the time you finish studying it, we will have gone and created a new reality. We have people like Niall Ferguson, neoconservative, Robert Kagan, a book called Power and Paradise, all on the right here, talking about the United States as an empire. We have people who now work for the Council on Foreign Relations, people like Walter Russell Mead, who wrote a really wonderful book in the 1980s called Mortal Splendor, in which he describes the growth of the U.S. empire and how it works. Or Ray Takeya, who has a really fine new book now called Hidden Iran, you know, which places U.S. policy in an imperial context. And you have people like Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was a national security advisor to President Carter, who's been very clear that the United States is an empire, wrote a book called The Grand Chessboard, in which he describes the fundamental structure of the empire and what the United States needs to do to maintain it. In fact, you know, if you look at our, you know, there's the stuff they didn't teach us in school and also the stuff that they did teach us. So to appreciate that when the first Europeans came to the Atlantic coast, where I live, you know, they began with a genocide. They had the right idea. They had the ideological foundations for building an empire. They were white. They were Christian. They had the truth. And they were out to set new lives. By the time we get to the Continental Congress in 1789, let's appreciate, you know, the worldview of the people who are coming together. They're creating a new government, a new society. And what were their models? I mean, you know, be compassionate for these people a little bit. Their models, you know, were the British and the French and the Spanish and the Portuguese empires, Rome and Greece, and they were really quite clear about it. So if you read the work of one of my favorite historians, William Appleman Williams, you see how the Continental Congress was, among other things, a debate on how the empire should be structured, how large the metropolitan center should be, how diverse its population should be so the empire could grow. How many people here remember the name Seward? Seward, okay, a number of people. Seward is best known for Seward's Folly, as someone here in the audience is telling us. Seward in 1850, is saying that if the United States is going to become the world's dominant power, it has to control Asia. And in order to do that, he says there's essentially two ways to get to Asia. There's a northern route and there's a southern route. The southern route takes you through Hawaii, through Guam, through the Philippines. But that was already sort of possessed by the British in Hawaii and the Spanish in the Philippines and Guam. Or you could go the northern route via Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. So later on, we at least got the northern route to Asia. On the other side of the Civil War, before that, let's go back a little bit. Let's go back to the Louisiana Purchase. I got a new nickel the other day, and there's on the back of it, it's celebrating the Louisiana Purchase, right? So that is the United States literally buying a major chunk of the French Empire. And then, of course, there's the genocide to settle it. In 1848, there's the war against Mexico. Here we stand and sit and live in the booty of that war. We took half of Mexico. By the 1870s, we're essentially consolidating the continental empire. Now, people remember in the 1870s, you learned about it in elementary school, the veterans of the Northern forces got 40 acres and a mule, basically a way to get people to settle the land of the Midwest to fill out our continental empire. And I was just in Iowa, and let me reconfirm for you, the land in that area is incredibly rich. So they planted a lot of corn, a lot of wheat. And by the 1870s, they were growing so much corn and so much wheat that the bottom fell out of the market. The value of that produce had gone down about 400%. People were losing their farms. Even though they're growing food, they couldn't feed their families. And they started making demands that Washington should conquer the markets of Latin America. Well, why not? I mean, we had the Monroe Doctrine, which said that Latin America was ours. But the U.S. elite hadn't quite bought it at that point. But come the 1890s, you're in a different situation. When I went to college, when you're a freshman, you go to college and you don't understand much about the world. And so I went to school with conflicting ambitions. I wanted to be a freedom rider and I wanted to be a U.S. diplomat. It didn't quite work. So I went to Georgetown School of Foreign Service. And for a variety of reasons, even though I was quite clear I wasn't going into the Foreign Service, I got my education there. And we had a fantastic professor of U.S. diplomatic history, Jules Davids, who we didn't know at the time had been the primary ghostwriter for Kennedy's Profiles in Courage. He was a wonderful lecturer. And I remember when he got to the 1890s, on the one hand, he's telling us that we have people like Henry Cabot Lodge, Theodore Roosevelt, Admiral Mahan, who are clear that the United States now has the industrial power to begin really moving to replace Britain as the world's dominant power. And that is an island power, a belief that, that empire really depends, global domination depends on controlling Eurasia. We had to do it as an island nation. How does an island nation do it? It does it with a big navy. So they built a giant navy. And much as, for example, the North Koreans will parade their missiles in Pyongyang on the holidays, they sent the Great White Fleet around the world to announce the U.S. as a power. 1890s, we had a huge economic depression. It may be stretching it a little bit, but you can look at that as making the Great Depression of the 30s look like prosperity. There was a massive turmoil in the United States. And at this point, the U.S. elite gets it. We need to conquer the markets of China, and we need to conquer the markets of Latin America. And this will allow us to export our goods, which will keep American workers at work and peaceful. There'll be social peace. And, of course, there'll be great profits for those who own corporations that are producing this and exporting it. And I remember David's lecturing us and reminding us that in those days, the warships and the merchant ships were fueled by coal. And they could only go but so far because of how much they had. So you needed coaling stations. Okay. Then he went to the map and showed us where Subic Bay is on the west coast of the Philippines. Described it as a absolutely beautiful, perfect, deep harbor. And then showed us how it was just jumping off point to get to the Chinese coast. So the warship Maine blows up in Havana Harbor. To this day, we don't know how that happened, but this was an occasion for McKinley to meet God and to hear God tell him that it was our responsibility to go kick the ass of the Spaniards. So we conquered Cuba and Puerto Rico, made it ours, controlled the Caribbean and the northern approaches to Latin America, used that as the occasion to conquer Guam, conquer the Philippines, and annex Hawaii. So the foundations of our global empire were in place then. I mean, we have interventions in Nicaragua in 1923. We sent troops into China in 1900 and so on and so forth. During the First World War, we demonstrate that we are the rising power. But we really don't consolidate U.S. global control until the end of the Second World War. So, you know, the collapse of the British and French empires. In the Middle East, we win what the State Department describes as one of the greatest material prizes in world history, the oil of the Middle East, comparable to all the gold and silver of the New World that was used to finance the Industrial Revolution, used to finance the European colonial experience. And, of course, to maintain that, we've overthrown governments, we've bought governments, we've invaded countries, and we've threatened nuclear war at least a dozen times. So we have an empire, so we'll just kind of put that one aside now. Let's then move to how nuclear weapons have been used to either expand or to enforce it. You know, in 1995, that was the 50th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and there was a pretty good exhibit that was organized for the Smithsonian Institution on that occasion. It had some flaws, and I was part of a group of historians who met and tried to push the Smithsonian to make it better. But it included a number of interesting things. It included information about how the United States had firebombed 62 major cities in Japan, basically burnt them to the ground, how we had held out four cities to be primary nuclear targets, how the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Leahy, was advising Truman that Japan's surrender could be arranged on terms that were acceptable to the United States, how Japan's diplomats were reaching out to the United States and also to the Soviet Union to mediate in order to end the war, because the Japanese knew the war was lost, how people like General, later President Eisenhower, said it wasn't necessary to hit them with that terrible thing. It included photographs of what had happened. It included testimony from some of the survivors. And it had some more that I'll tell you about in a second. But we weren't allowed to see that. The Air Force and conservative members of Congress thought that if we questioned and undermined the legitimacy of the first atomic bombings, then the U.S. nuclear program as a whole would be placed in jeopardy. And they were right. But one of the functions is that the great lie about how the atomic bombings of these two cities saved you know, 500,000 or 1 million U.S. lives, that myth, that lie, is still at work. So some of the other information that it had to do with why the atomic bombs were actually used. There were multiple reasons. I mean, there's always bureaucratic momentum. You had Truman's political mentor, Burns, who he made his Secretary of State, telling him that if the U.S. people learned that we had spent $2 billion on nuclear weapons and not used them, that Truman would face considerable difficulty in getting elected in the 1948 presidential election. But as it explained, the determinative reasons had to do with the Soviet Union. I'm not sure if it included this, but Joseph Rotblat, who was one of the senior scientists at Los Alamos, arrived in 1943. And when he gets there, General Groves, who's running the whole operation, tells him, look, it's not about Germany, it's not about Japan, it's about the Soviet Union. And Rotblat has the moral courage to quit. The determining reasons were that the Soviet Union was to come into the war on August the 15th. And in Europe, we already had to divide influence with the Soviets in Europe. I mean, they basically pushed the Nazis back from Leningrad and Stalingrad, you know, back east of Berlin. And as Burns said, you know, why should we share booty in Asia after we've done all the bleeding in Asia? Let's take it for ourselves. The fear was that if we did the prolonged negotiations, and we had you know, broken their codes, we knew what they were trying to surrender, what the terms were. They're trying to surrender on terms that we ultimately accepted, that Hirohito remain on the throne. So the fear was that we'd have to share influence with them in Manchuria, in northern China, in Korea, potentially even in Japan. So bring the war to a quick end so you don't have to share influence with them. The other, as Truman wrote in his diaries, is if the bombs worked, we'd have a hammer over those boys, meaning the Soviets. I mean, it's a terror weapon. We wanted to show the Soviet Union what the weapons could do, that what we could do to a city, and that we had the will to use it against civilians twice. One of the things I've long wanted to do and haven't had the time or resources to do, I'd love to have a Hiroshima monument as close to Harvard University as I possibly can, because it was the president of Harvard, James Conant, who was on a thing called the interim committee, who suggested what the criteria for the target should be. Cities with military functions but with densely packed workers' homes. So civilians were targeted from the get-go. So from the beginning, it's been about empire. It's been about expanding our influence, in this case, in Asia. Now, remember that the Soviet Union, you know, we're told that nuclear weapons are about deterrence. Well, we weren't exactly deterring anybody in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We weren't deterring anybody in 1946 when the Soviets didn't have nuclear weapons. With the encouragement of the United States, the Soviets had occupied a northern province of Iran. Through that, we were able to provide food and munitions to our wartime ally, the Soviet Union. But when they were slow to withdraw, Truman called the Soviet ambassador into the White House and told him that if they didn't begin their withdrawal within 48 hours, Moscow would cease to exist. The Soviet withdrawal began in 24 hours. As I was beginning to learn about this stuff a long time ago, one of the people I turned to for help was Daniel Ellsberg, who lives not too far from here. And most of us know Dan in terms of his work on the Pentagon Papers, the secret history of U.S. decision-making during the Vietnam War, and then his willingness to risk life imprisonment. In fact, he was sentenced to 109 years for the crime of making that history public to us in an effort to try to stop the killing in Vietnam. What most of us don't know about Dan is that he played a really significant role in designing U.S. nuclear war policy for President Kennedy, for President Johnson, and to a much lesser extent in the first months of the Nixon administration. And what Dan taught me and has written about is that the United States has repeatedly used a nuclear weapon in the same way that, say, an armed robber uses it when he breaks into a 7-Eleven and confronts the cashier. Pull out the trigger, point it at someone's head. Whether or not you pull the trigger, you've still used the gun. And so, as I said earlier, we've done this on about 30 occasions. Let me run over some of the Cold War incidents, and then I want to focus more on post-Cold War so we understand the kind of current dangers of this. And again, most of us were taught to think that our nuclear weapons had more to do about the Soviet Union, you know, and deterrence than anything else. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Jones testified that deterrence has never been our policy. It's a dangerous policy, and that's not what we've been pursuing. In fact, as we say now in this Bush's policies, deterrence is to deter other countries from taking courses of action. That action could include nuclear attack. It could also include raising the price of oil. So you have, for example, in 1950, during the Korean War, Truman threatens nuclear attack against the Koreans a number of times. You have MacArthur, who wants to turn the border between North Korea and China into a radioactive belt of cobalt that will permanently divide Korea from China. Many people think that the reason that MacArthur was fired was that he wanted to use nuclear weapons. That's not true. What it was that Truman wanted a more reliable finger on his atomic bomb, General Ridgway, and so he replaced him with Ridgway. You have Eisenhower campaigning, saying he can end the Korean War, which at that point was just basically a stalemate and had more to do with you know, with status, you know, what were the terms and conditions of POW exchanges. And so, as he said, we'll let the world know that we won't be confined by any gentleman's agreement, that, you know, we'll threaten to use our nuclear weapons and not limit it to the field of the battle, meaning threatening Soviet Union and China as well, and that we'll get what we want. And lo and behold, he got what he wanted. And as Nixon tells us, he learned from Eisenhower. He learned how to make these threats from Eisenhower. Eisenhower used them repeatedly. And to remember that in the 1950s, and some of you were alive then, some of you were older than I was then, you know, people had lived through the Great Depression, had lived through the Second World War. Life had been hard. And Eisenhower wanted to do economic development. He wanted people to have more prosperity. But he couldn't do this by driving up the military budget, say, to the levels that we have today. And so, as he said, with our nuclear arsenal, with a policy of massive retaliation, you know, for anything that the other side does, we'll wipe them out with nuclear weapons. That way, we could make our military forces viable all over the world. So you have Eisenhower offering the French two nuclear weapons to break the siege at Dien Bien Phu in Vietnam. The French had the wisdom to say no, thank you. The wind might blow the wrong way. You have in 1955 a crisis with China over Taiwan and threats with the Chinese backing down. 1956, threats during the Suez Crisis. 1958, another crisis with China, and they backed down under the U.S. threat. You have a it's a funny story here, actually. I mean, it's funny in retrospect. The number two CIA agent in the Middle East in the 1950s was a man named Wilbur Crane Eveland. And in the 1970s, he was feeling guilty about what he had done. So he wrote his memoirs, a book called Ropes of Sand. In it, he describes how in 1957 at the U.S. Embassy in Damascus, he would fill up the trunk of his Chevrolet convertible with money, $500,000. And then he would drive – that was a lot of money in those days. And then he would drive over the Lebanon Mountains to the presidential palace in Beirut and give that money personally to President Camille Chamoun. Chamoun wanted it that way. He wanted it to come directly to him. And then he proceeded to buy the parliamentary elections of 1957. And he did it in such a ham-handed way that his forces won so overwhelmingly that it was obvious that the election was corrupt, which led to the first spasms of civil war in Lebanon. Well, this is at a time of rising Arab nationalism. Nasser is growing in power. We're dealing with what General Maxwell Taylor later called the jugular vein of Western capitalism, the oil of the region. We didn't want any problems. So we sent in the Marines. We also sent with the Marines some nuclear weapons. And one of the great fears was just as we were sending off the Marines, there's a revolution in a country called Iraq, and they're overthrowing the British-installed monarch. And the fear is that this revolution in Iraq may spin off into a country called Kuwait. So make sure we've got nuclear weapons with us. It has been reported in the past that when the U.S. Marines landed on the shores of Beirut, beautiful beaches there, that not only were they greeted by popsicle salesmen, but that they also brought their nuclear weapons onto the beach. They were greeted by popsicle salesmen. They did not bring the nuclear weapons onto the beach. But what we aren't usually told is that, you know, the head of the Lebanese army, you know, was a patriot. And he wasn't so sure that it was a good thing that the Marines had landed. And the question was whether the Lebanese army would do what we say do. And so Eisenhower's personal representative, a civilian, met with him, pointed offshore, told him that the nuclear weapons were there, pointed to downtown Beirut, and said, you know, if you want this city to be here, you'll do what we say do. And the Lebanese army did what we say do. You had further threats. I mean, in Vietnam, I'll come to Vietnam in a second, but in the Middle East, again, during the Six-Day War, again in 1973, in 1980, Carter puts out the Carter Doctrine. The United States will use any means necessary to ensure its continued dominance in the Persian Gulf. So there's a long history there. Let me come to Vietnam, and then I'll jump ahead to post-Cold War. In Vietnam, some people here will remember the siege at Khe San. It's a fortress up near the border with Laos. The thought was strategically that it might serve as a choke point to keep the North Vietnamese from bringing their troops down the Ho Chi Minh Trail and coming into Vietnam. When General Giap on the Vietnamese side looked at it, he thought, well, this might be a replay of Dien Bien Phu. Maybe we can get the U.S. to concentrate its forces there. We can wipe out a lot of them. The other thing is if we get them to concentrate their forces there, maybe we can go around them and hit the coastal area in a thing which became the Tet Offensive, which was the end of that war. In any event, Westmoreland went for the bait and started putting more and more troops into Khe San, into the fortress there, thinking that this would give him a greater concentration of North Vietnamese forces, that they could then bomb with B-52s and wipe out massive numbers of Vietnamese in what Westmoreland and the U.S. military referred to as Indian country. Well, Vietnamese was both North Vietnam and the National Liberation Front. Their siege was intense. And there was questions as to whether or not, in fact, it might become another Dien Bien Phu. Lyndon Johnson said, I don't want another Dien Bien Phu. Or he kind of chewed it up when he said it. But in the middle of that, Dean Rusk testifies before Congress and indicates that we might have to use nuclear weapons. General Westmoreland is contacted and asked whether he thinks nuclear weapons will be necessary. He says, well, not quite yet, but the plans are made. And Johnson also, in a press conference, indicates that we won't be needing nuclear weapons yet. He hasn't ordered them yet. Well, that's the way of sending the signal. The deeper threat came several years later. People here will remember the 1968 election when Nixon ran with his secret plan to end the war. Remember that secret plan? And we all knew that Nixon was lying. I mean, here's the used car salesman who's been lying all his life. But in truth, he did have a secret plan. I mean, it's now been revealed by Haldeman in his diaries, by Nixon in his diaries, and by lots of other people who have studied it and written about it, and I'm one of them now, too. His secret plan was to practice what he had learned from Eisenhower. He called it the madman theory. What he said he would do would be to send the signal to the Vietnamese and to the Russians that, you know, Nixon is such an, you know, such a crazy anti-communist. You know, he is such an ideologue, so mad that we can barely keep his finger off the nuclear button. And we do that, he said, the Vietnamese will come running to Paris and accept whatever terms we want. So in the summer of 1969, unbeknownst to all but a very few people, that signal was sent. There was a meeting between Kissinger and the Soviet ambassador Dobrynin in which we threatened to either destroy all of North Vietnam's dikes or to hit it with nuclear weapons unless they agreed to our terms in Paris. A message was sent through Ceausescu, the dictator in Romania. And there was a French diplomat named Santonet who had strong ties with the North Vietnamese, and the signal was sent. But the Vietnamese didn't blink. They figured that they were here before the United States in Vietnam, and they'd be in Vietnam after the United States, and whatever the United States did. Well, come October, and there's different takes on how this actually transpired, and I report the several in my chapter there. Nixon, even secret from almost all of his most senior generals, moves U.S. forces onto the highest level of nuclear alert. In Nebraska, he's lining up B-52s wing to wing, armed with atomic bombs. He has warplanes with atomic bombs even in civilian airports. He's putting U.S. Navy and Air Force on nuclear alert in Europe, in the Mediterranean, in Asia, even in Latin America, and taking B-52s, nuclear-armed B-52s, and flying right up along the Soviet coast. This goes on for weeks. This goes on for about 29 days. The military is freaking out because they're afraid that they just can't keep this level of alert and mobilization without an accident. Some people here may have gone to Washington for the moratorium in 1969. In the summer, at the same time that Nixon's planning this ultimatum, people in Kissinger's national security staff, not Kissinger himself, are writing memos saying that if the U.S. implements the November ultimatum, there will be such an uprising in the United States that Nixon will have to use as much force to repress the rebellion here in the United States as he will have used against the Vietnamese. A couple hundred thousand people went to Washington for that moratorium demonstration, carrying the names of the U.S. war dead. And Nixon's PR flack said he could care less. He's just watching a football game. But if you're really, you know, if you're really having difficulty going to sleep one night, you can read Nixon's memoirs, where he tells you that when he learned that 200,000 people had come to Washington, he knew he couldn't implement the nuclear threat. There's other takes that indicate that even before he did it, even before he put the forces on nuclear alert, that he had blinked and that he had feared that he couldn't actually follow through on it. In any event, Nixon ultimately gave his second greatest speech of his political career. the silent majority speech, which was in its own you know, complicated, evil way, brilliant. Because the U.S. had made this threat. The Chinese knew it. The Russians knew it. This is the height of the Cold War. How do you back off of a nuclear threat? And the way he backed off of it was to say, sort of like Bush is saying today, we'll be fighting in Vietnam forever. We're not going to lose this war. And then orchestrated tens of thousands of telegrams around the country to, you know, celebrate his great speech, and the right wing and the American people were behind him. And that led him back off of the threat. Let me jump to the post-Cold War and then kind of wrap up this talk because it gets late. People here will remember that very delicious period between the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. That was a period when we wondered, what is this $350 billion military budget all about? What is the rationale for our continued possession of nuclear weapons? What's the rationale for our military alliances around the world, or our hundreds of military bases around the world? And the question was, nobody knew. And where was it going to go? None of us knew. And then Saddam Hussein, bless him, provided the answer. Right? He invaded Kuwait. So you have President Bush the Elder, everyone here will remember this, saying that we're about to create a new world order in which what we say goes, uses this crisis to exercise and actually discipline our alliances. So it informs, for example, the Irish government that we have this agreement that we can use Shannon Airport for transporting our planes and troops and munitions. We didn't need it, but damn it, we were going to have access to Shannon Airport. Japan, which was respecting its constitution a little more then than it is now, they said they couldn't join the war with us. Okay, you can give us $13 billion to help pay for it and use that as part of the pressure that's now leading Japan to try to revise its constitution and has already sent its troops to Iran. What we didn't know about that, well, actually, some of it did get communicated at the time. In the buildup for that war, President Nixon, Vice President Quayle, some people will remember that man, then Secretary of Defense Cheney, and Secretary of State Baker, all threatened Iraq that if it even thought about using its chemical weapons, that we would attack it with nuclear weapons. We moved anywhere from 700 to 1,000 nuclear weapons to the theater, surrounded Iraq with them to back up that threat in the event they weren't used. One of the things that happens, that how many people here know the name Brigadier General Glossop? Not a household name yet, right? If you learn about him, you understand another dimension of U.S. nuclear preparations and preparations for nuclear war. Glossop was the man on General Schwarzkopf's staff with the responsibility of identifying targets in Iraq that were going to hit and the weapons that were going to use to hit them. And he was looking at Iraq's biological warfare plants and thinking, if we hit them with conventional weapons, the fires may not be hot enough to consume all those pathogens. We should hit them with tactical nuclear weapons. The flames will be really hot, a million degrees or more. Of course, the wind might blow the wrong way, but we're not going to think about that. So he passes on this suggestion to General Schwarzkopf, the man who is organizing, the attack. And Schwarzkopf does not say no. Schwarzkopf passes it on to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where Colin Powell says, we won't need to use them this time. But it's in here that you see the forces that have been leading Bush to have a doctrine to build and deploy more usable nuclear weapons. It's this that was behind the bunker buster or the new generation of nuclear weapons, the so-called reliable replacement warhead, and so on. Following Bush the Elder, you've got Clinton. Now, we think of Clinton as compared to our current president, as almost a sweetheart. But, let's remember that Sweetheart early on went to the DMZ in Korea and said, if you even think about crossing this line, you're annihilated. In 1994, there's growing concern about North Korea's nuclear program. Clinton almost stumbles into it would have been an absolutely catastrophic war against North Korea. And it took former President Carter to kind of pull the irons out of the fire, negotiate the agreed framework. You had Clinton threatening nuclear attack against Iraq, and also against Libya. And then our current president, blessed be he, threatened nuclear attack in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and has a nuclear posture review, nuclear doctrine, that reiterates our commitment to first strike, calls for the construction of new nuclear weapons, accelerating the preparations for resumption of testing in Nevada, and actually names seven countries as primary U.S. nuclear targets. What are they? Iraq, the axis of evil, Iraq, Iran, North Korea, Libya, Syria, Russia, and China. China, of course, are most likely a strategic competitor in their language. Let me do one more anecdote before I kind of come to the conclusion here. In 1998, I read a small little item in a Japanese newspaper that said that there were going to be NGO meetings in Tokyo to negotiate a new strategic frame of reference for Northeast Asia. And it said that the U.S. NGO representatives would be Joe Nye, who'd been number three in the Pentagon under Clinton, who's now back at Harvard, and Ezra Vogel, who had been in charge of intelligence, Asian intelligence at the State Department in the first Clinton administration, and Joe Nye's compadre. Well, my office is about a mile from Harvard, and I sometimes go to seminars there, and I ask embarrassing questions from time to time. So I knew that Joe Nye wouldn't meet with me. So I said, well, let's try Ezra Vogel. And I got this meeting with Vogel. And I asked him, I said, well, what are you hoping to do in these meetings? And, of course, the counterparts would be, you know, the equivalent figures from the Chinese and Japanese elite. And I said, well, what I want to do is I want to negotiate a grand bargain with China. I said, well, how do you do that? And so what we do is we threaten to surround China with missile defenses that can neutralize all of their missiles. Neutralize all of their missiles. And then we say, let's make a deal. I said, well, what's the deal? He said, well, the deal is that they agree not to deploy any more aggressive weapons than they already have and not to adopt any more aggressive military doctrine than they already have. And we then limit our missile deployments around them. And I said, well, that's interesting, but that leaves, you know, several hundred U.S. military bases and the nuclear-armed 7th Fleet and the rest of our nuclear weapons and our militarization of space all pointed at China. And he says to me, so? I mean, the vision is to go back to the power relations that abided after, you know, after the Opium Wars. This is the vision. And it helps us to understand why the Russians now are somewhat concerned about our plan to deploy missile defenses in Eastern Europe. The idea is total dominance. And while these missile defenses don't work now, the idea is you put the infrastructure in place, and over the course of the next decades, we build them up so that they can. I want to conclude. I want to come back to the question of how we get out of this. How do we get out of this place? We are in a situation where, as I indicated from those questions from the Iranian radio, or quotations that I could give you from Mohammed El-Baradei, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, where the hypocrisy doesn't work anymore, where the combination of the U.S. commitment to nuclear dominance and its threats really have become the primary force that pushes proliferation. I mean, the North Koreans decided they needed to get a nuclear weapon in 1953 after those threats. It took them a while to get there, another five nuclear threats from the United States, among others. One of the, you have these experiences in life that, sometimes kind of cut deep into your psyche and into your memory. And I was in Hiroshima some years ago when Joseph Rotblat, the senior scientist from the Manhattan Project who quit, was speaking there. He's probably about 90 years old at the time, big, tall, robust, and high energy. And he said, the human species faces a very stark choice. We can either completely eliminate our nuclear weapons or we see their global proliferation and use. There's no halfway. He said, why? He said, because no nation will long tolerate what it perceives to be an unjust imbalance of power, or in this case, terror. So basically, there are three ways to equalize the imbalance of terror. On the one hand, we can implement Article 6, negotiate the elimination of our nuclear weapons, or we can see the global proliferation, or as we see in 9/11, other forces can use asymmetrical means to terrorize us, and you know there's no return address for a nuclear bomb on that. Now, one of the things that we don't know, I mean, the Los Angeles Times may be a pretty good newspaper. The New York Times is a pretty good newspaper. But there's a lot that it doesn't report. There's news that's fit to print that they don't print. For example, they don't print that just about every year the General Assembly of the United Nations votes overwhelmingly, that the nuclear powers should fulfill their commitments under Article 6. You have governments like Malaysia and Costa Rica this year introducing the drafts of treaties that give you the roadmap. This is a draft treaty that can be used to actually be the foundation for the steps that are taken. The World Court in 1996 – no, this is reported in the Times or the Times. In 1996, the World Court, in an advisory opinion, not only said that the use and threatened use of nuclear weapons is a total violation of international law, but also reminded the nuclear powers of their legal obligation to implement Article 6. In the 2000, these numbers get strange, you know, the 2000, year 2000, NPT review conference, as it was facing collapse in part because the U.S. was stiff-arming it and not willing to make steps toward implementing or accommodating Article 6, you know, radical governments like Ireland, Mexico, Brazil, New Zealand forced the nuclear powers led by the United States to reiterate their irrevocable commitment to fulfill Article 6 and to agree to take 13 steps in that direction. Of those 13 steps, the United States has taken half of one. It has negotiated a comprehensive test ban treaty, but it's yet to ratify it. We've got a long ways to go. Other elements of the if you will, the roadmap, include the negotiation of a fissile material cutoff treaty. Basically, what this would include would be doing a verifiable inventory of the world's fissile materials that can be used ultimately for making nuclear weapons, then to put it under lock and key, and then to begin to reprocess it and not enrich it, but de-enrich it. At the moment, there are negotiations going on for this, but the one caveat that the Bush administration is making is that the treaty should not be verifiable. Well, you know, it's more Bush smoke and mirrors, you know. There are weapons of mass destruction in Iran. We have to fear the Iranians, even though in 2003 they put forward a comprehensive proposal for us that would have dealt with nuclear weapons and Israel-Palestine and Hamas. And then ultimately, I think what it comes down to is you. You know, I can remember during the Poor People's Campaign, I was in the SCLC office, and I was talking to a man named Bill Moyers, who has one of his books out here on the table, a great strategist. And, you know, I was this kid, you know, this impertinent kid. And I said to him, you know, look, this is going to be hard going. I mean, there's not even a legislative agenda for the Poor People's Campaign. How are we going to succeed? And he turned to me and said, you know, when it's the bottom of the ninth inning and you're behind and there's two outs and you've got two strikes, you've got nothing better to do than to give it your all, because if you don't, you know you're going to lose. So, you know, we are in a dangerous situation. I mean, I think we, you know, I think we're required to be honest, right? I mean, if we care about our lives, if we care about other people's lives, if we care about our children and grandchildren, we're going to have to take Joseph Rotblat at his word. We're going to have to recognize that if we don't get rid of these weapons, they're going to be used either by the United States or by other countries. And so that means, I think, sometimes doing impertinent things. It means if any of the candidates come by anywhere where you are, you need to ask them that question about genocide and Iran. You need to ask them if it's appropriate for a democratic country to have, as Bill Clinton said, the cornerstone of its policy being preparations and threats of inflicting genocide or omnicide. It means for those of you who belong to churches or synagogues or have access to schools, you know, we've got to begin educating our communities. I mean, people are unaware You don't build a social movement unless people understand what's at play, what's really out there. And we have to do those things like call our members of Congress when they have their town meetings, meet with our members of Congress. And sometimes we have to take more radical and inspired action as it occurs to us. So I'll close with that.
That was Joseph Gerson, Director of Programs for the American Friends Service Committee, speaking last year in Los Angeles. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Next, I'm going to read you a commentary by the British journalist and author Robert Fisk that was published in the London Independent on November 8th. It's titled, "Obama Has to Pay for 8 Years of Bush's Delusions." Fisk wrote, "American lawyers defending 6 Algerians before a habeas corpus hearing in Washington this week learned some very odd things about U.S. intelligence after 9/11. From among the millions of raw reports from American spies and their assets around the world came a CIA Middle East warning about a possible kamikaze-style attack on a U.S. Navy base at a South Pacific island location. The only problem was that no such Navy base existed on the island, and no U.S. 7th Fleet warship had ever been there. In all seriousness, a U.S. military investigation earlier reported that Osama bin Laden had been spotted shopping at a post office on a U.S. military base in East Asia. That this nonsense was disseminated around the world by those tasked to defend the United States in the, quote, war on terror, shows the fantasy environment in which the Bush regime has existed these past 8 years. If you can believe that bin Laden drops by a shopping mall on an American military base, then you can believe that everyone you arrest is a terrorist, that Arabs are terrorists, that they can be executed, that living terrorists must be tortured, and that everything a tortured man says can be believed, that it is legitimate to invade sovereign states, to grab the telephone records of everyone in America. As Bob Herbert put it in the New York Times a couple of years ago, the Bush administration wanted these records which, quote, contain crucial documentation of calls for a Chinese takeout in Terre Haute, Indiana, and birthday greetings to Grandma in Talladega, Alabama, to help in the search for Osama bin Laden, close quote. There was no stopping Bush when it came to trampling on the U.S. Constitution. All that was new was that he was now applying the same disrespect for liberty in America that he had shown in the rest of the world. But how is Barack Obama going to repair the titanic damage which his vicious, lying predecessor has perpetrated around the globe and within the U.S. itself?